Hello, friends. This is Against Everyone with Connor Abib. This is a very personal episode with Una Mullally. Una is a friend of mine and also a great and very wildly popular Irish journalist and artist and activist. And we have worked on multiple projects together. She's been on the show many times. But we've also worked on projects together with the National Concert Hall here, doing an anthroposophy event and doing some other cultural events. Even though the episode is about collapse and renewal and apocalypse and the end of the world and the beginning of new worlds, we go about that by talking about pretty intense events in our own lives. This episode is a lead up to an event that I'm doing here in Dublin, but is also an online event, at least if you are listening to this in early 2024. If not, then the event may have already passed. But the event is called The Beginning is Near, Apocalypse and Renewal, and it's with me and guests of the show, Una, and then Srećko Horvat, and Mark O'Connell. And the idea is to have us all talk about apocalypse, what's happening, the total failure, collapse, destruction, Ragnaroking of our world, and what comes after that. What maybe we are already after that, but what's rising? What is being born? What's becoming free? What's growing? And how can we direct that and be a part of it? So that's called The Beginning is Near. And if you want to buy tickets for that, it is online. You can watch it live on Thursday, the 28th of March, so the day before Good Friday, at 7 o'clock Dublin time. And if for some reason you can't actually watch the event online live at that time, you get access to a recording. But if you do watch it live online, you'll be able to participate in some of the exercises we're going to offer. It's an immersive discussion. It's not just a bunch of people talking, and I think it's going to be a great event. It's the first time Srećko has been in Ireland for any event at all, and I'm really excited about that. Now, if you want to buy tickets, you just go to the easiest way is connorhabib.com/events, and it'll have a link to tickets there. If the event has already passed, well, you missed a great event, but don't worry. I'll do more with all three of those guests in the future. Maybe not all at the same time, but connorhabib.com/events to buy tickets. They're just 15 euro, which is like 16 bucks if you're in the US, so it's not super expensive either. This episode, like I said, is a bit of a prelude to that, because Una and I wanted to think about what it means to have intense proximity to death, despair, collapse, and how we found strength in that, and strength that might not be applicable to everybody. So in other words, when Una and I talk about our own life events, we don't have pat advice, do this, 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 this for people. But we have instead visions or images of what the truth might have been in those events. So something that we can share. Something that I've become increasingly convinced of is that when we're talking about apocalypse and renewal, when we're talking about massive collective world problems and moving forward, we have to continuously do this movement from the self to the all, from the individual and the cultural sphere into the gathering of two or more, or the political and rights sphere into what is the economic and environmental sphere, the all, everybody. We have to move up and down that scale to figure out how we're going to approach all the problems of apocalypse and opportunities of apocalypse and problems and opportunities of renewal together. And so as we go into our own lives to understand resilience, flexibility, strength, softness, vulnerability, all those things can tell us something about how to approach world problems and world catastrophes, disasters, violence, and atrocity. But the lesson might not be very pat or prescribable, because it has to go up through those other levels if it's going to contribute or play a part in the world, and then back down to us. So how do we talk about that? That's something Una and I really try to get into on this episode. I'm really happy to offer it to you, and I hope it's helpful. It, like I said, is very personal. I talk about this time in my life that was very, very hard, this moment that I almost anchor some of my sense of self around, and I think Una's story about a time in her life is no different. Here's the part where I usually tell you to support the show on patreon.com/ConnorBeeb. I still do that now. I also, this time, will tell you to come to the event, participate in the event, watch it, listen to it, talk about it with your friends. The beginning is near apocalypse and renewal. ConnorBeeb.com/events. All right. Until then, or after then, if that event has already collapsed into the past, here's my episode with Una Mullally. Hello, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Beeb. Hi, Una Mullally.
Hello, Connor.
I want to start by talking about how we have always, every day, but collectively also, an opportunity to walk away from a way that we've connected with other people for a long, long time. It'll sound like it's bad to walk away, but through suffering, we connect to people through their suffering. I want to talk about what it means to connect to people through love and not suffering. And the reason why I say walking away from it is because there's so many images of suffering right now, of absolute terrible pain. And the way I see people disconnecting, or even worse, delighting or finding entertainment in the images of suffering means that there's been a coordinated, in some ways, gradual, in other ways, effort or transformation of suffering from the site of connection into a site of division. And what would it mean if we connected to each other through love? In other words, we understood and cared for each other through love, not through, oh, I see that person hurting, I know what it's like to hurt. Now, I actually want to start by talking about my own suffering and your own suffering in a way, but I want to see if we can take that conversation into a place of relating through a kind of love that's not just about, well, I understand what that pain might be like. I have pain too. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, just to say on the aspect of the visual storm of suffering and what that does to us and how we take it in, I found it really useful recently to reread Sontag's, both on photography and regarding the pain of others. And I think if anybody's struggling to derive meaning from this compendium of war and death happening in visually in real time, and the significance and the importance of that, and also how people can trivialize it and what it does to us when we consume it, I think those are two really great books to revisit.
Yeah, regarding the pain of others especially is fresh in my memory, even though I read it, I think the day it came out, I was so excited. I worked at a bookstore. It's like, yes, I got it. And I read it in a day. And it still resonates with me. I mean, and that was decades ago now. It was so powerful. And I think people don't really have a guide anymore for how to witness and respond to suffering. Because the default was, oh, if you see someone suffering, you sympathize with them, or you help them, or whatever. And that's just clearly not the case for many, many reasons that I don't just think is we've seen so many images of suffering that we've been inoculated. I mean, there's a particularly really deeply cynical and I thought kind of terrible take from someone who I otherwise like. I won't name her, but who's an anti-imperialist sort of influencer, whatever that means. But she was saying, oh, like all this horror media, violent movies and books and all that is teaching people to not care about, you know, dead bodies. And then, you know, you go see them in movies and then you see it on the screen and you don't know how to connect the two. And I think that that's such nonsense, actually. But I'm just bringing that up as one of the many ways in which people are grasping for theories about why people aren't responding to seeing images of suffering. We're seeing genocide unfold in real time, you know, on our screens. It's something that people keep saying and saying and saying. And it's like, well, it's actually, unfortunately, far more tangled up than that. And in some ways, way worse in the sense that we don't have any understanding like that. That's presupposing like, oh, we should know how to respond to that. But actually, people don't even know how.
I think it's a lot to do with seeing as well. You know, I think in many cases, people either aren't seeing literally or really aren't seeing, you know. And I think this speaks to the difference between empathy and love, and how empathy can circle the wagons, actually, and be weaponized in bizarre ways, and how you know, empathy is almost kind of bequeathed or offered or given in a very different way to love. And you know, all related to in groups and concepts of community and relatability and solidarity, and who is deserving of, you know, ... so yeah, I think people need to kind of make the leap between empathy and love, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've been thinking about this in a way too where you know, fear can be instilled, fear can be generated in people, but love actually can't be compelled. It can't be made to happen in anyone. But it can be corralled and it can be limited and cordoned off in certain ways. It can be surrounded by something that looks like community, like you were just saying with in-group or whatever, where people only experience love within their own community. And then as soon anything that goes outside of that is, you know, beyond the boundary of where they understand how to express love or experience love. And so that becomes a threat, you know, to their community, which is why community is such a poisonous, in so many ways, such a poisonous thing that we think is a good thing. But I feel like at least I am like kind of just sort of talking around and wandering. But what I would like to do is maybe talk about times when you and I brushed up against things that look like the destruction of ourselves, the destruction of our own being. And the reason why is they're nothing, in a lot of ways, nothing like what people are going through, obviously, in war zones. And yet, if I'm to try to relate to somebody there, that's the first place I would go. I'd be like, well, when did my life seem like it was going to be destroyed? And how did I get out of that? What helped me? But and then interestingly, I have to also stand back and be like, and it's nothing like what someone there is going through. And so it's this weird dance of back and forth of like, I'm trying to find my way in through my suffering. And then I have to recognize the difference and then overcome the difference to see something else. And I think that that's a process from moving from love, suffering into relating through suffering into relating through love, or relating through suffering and a kind of sympathy and empathy to then getting, crossing some sort of threshold to relating to people through love. So maybe we could, does that make sense as a way to walk through?
Yeah, that makes sense because, you know, it goes without saying that individual suffering or an experience of it, and encounters with death and so on, you know, have very little to do with systemic and murder, you know, and mass murder and the structures and forces at play that facilitate those kind of things. But I think there's a lot about death and what that kind of feels like when one encounters the edges of it, that change a person and should. And I think, you know, we kind of constantly go back to this thing, like, you know, which can be a bit Instagram quote, which is, you know, if you want the world to change, then you have to change yourself. You know, if you want to have things really kind of move and alter, well, you know, the building block of that is the self. And so I think these kind of sometimes terrifying encounters and experiences offer this completely transformative point of view that, if welcomed, can soften the self towards a different kind of path that has much more love involved in it.
Yeah. So should I near death myself first, or do you want to?
You can near death yourself.
Okay. So, in 2007, I had been with my boyfriend, who's been on the show actually, my ex-boyfriend Jeb Havens, who's now my best friend. So, happy ending with that. But I broke up with him, and I started dating this guy. I just finished grad school. I was teaching at University of Massachusetts and going to school for creative writing, organismic and evolutionary biology. I had just finished, so I didn't have school. I didn't have a job. I didn't really know what I was going to do next. And I left Jeb and I started dating someone else who I won't name. And that was like a really intense, crazy relationship that just lasted a few months. I also confronted someone in my family for abusing me. And that person basically gaslit me and other family members. So I lost a huge chunk of my family. I lost my job. I lost my boyfriend. I lost my livelihood. And then that boyfriend that I had started dating, the guy I started dating, beat the shit out of me in a parking lot in Boston, punched me, broke my ribs, choked me, and I spent the entire next day in the hospital. And at the hospital, they did a CT scan on my abdomen to see if I had any organs split open, because I had some internal bleeding. And they told me, no, my organs weren't split open. But the nurse that had done the CT scan, I said, is everything okay? And she said, you're going to die. And then she went, I'm just kidding. The doctor will see you soon. And
I just actually can't with that.
I know. And then the doctor at the hospital told me, which is, I'm not really supposed to do this in an emergency room, I suppose, but the doctor said, you have lymphoma. And I was like, what? Like, I mean, it was just completely out of the blue. Obviously, I was there for something else, and I was obviously had a lot on my plate. And, you know, and my mom had died of cancer when I was 23. And so I really lived in a lot of fear of that. And I was like, well, couldn't this have, you know, couldn't things be like look weird to you, like because I was assaulted, couldn't blah blah blah. And he was just like insistent, and he said, well, you know, when I got in the CT scan, I was like, is this dangerous? And the nurse said, only if you do it more than like once a month. And the doctor was like, I need to come back in like a week and get another CT scan on your abdomen. It's like, well, the person in the that did this said, don't do it more than once a month. And he was like, yeah. And then the other nurse said, you're so lucky you caught it early. And she said, and she also said, the assault probably saved your life. All this information, like rushing, you know, I'm like 30 years old. And fuck. And so what I did was I just said, no, I'm not dealing with that. I don't believe you, and I'm not going to deal with it. And I'm not telling anybody to do that, by the way. I just want to be very, very clear. I wrote a whole essay about this whole thing called When You're Sick, You'll Wait for the Answer and None Will Come. I'm very clear in that again and again that I'm not giving anyone advice, because everybody's health life is their own. And there's so many individualized and intense factors around this that you, in some ways, it's like really difficult to give advice. That's why you have professionals, and some of them are terrible even then. But I just thought, if I walk into that puzzle of like what they're trying to put together and do, I'm going to die. I knew that. So I just walked away from it, and I held the abuse, the broken rib, the healing and, you know, contusions, and like scar tissue in my intestines and all this kind of stuff, plus the emotional intensity abuse. And I drove across the country by myself, from Massachusetts to California, and for years, just like back and forth with all these revelations, all this pain, all these things like coming in, falling away, coming in, falling away. And it wasn't until I still like would get freaked out about it, but now, just so everybody knows, that was almost 17 years ago. So I would have died if, you know, there was some progression, or at least be much worse off now than I am. And I had a few doctors tell me, you know, no, don't worry. One of them, who is the top lymphoma researcher, one of the top lymphoma researchers in the world, I met by chance, was like, oh, you self-cured. And I was like, what? He's like, oh, yeah, it happens all the time. Nobody talks about it. You know, and this is like the lymphoma expert, you know, like, and researcher. He's a medical researcher. And I mean, just crazy shit. And then also all the people in my life telling me that I needed to call the police, that I need to take legal action against the partner, that I should probably talk to that family member, that, you know, I was an idiot for not following the doctor's rules, like all those things that like came with it. So that's the collapse moment. There are other ones in my life too. And I sometimes feel that I make that the anchor of my life in a way that, because it was so pivotal, that I've missed some of the other moments that might actually even be more formative and fundamental to like who I am. But it's just because so much of it happened at once and just everything seemed to collapse. So it was a collapse of all the conditions that I had known in my life at that point. And I had to find my own way through it. And we can talk about the ways in which I did that, or found strength and found pain and trying to find strength and made mistakes and all of that. But that's just to give a portrait of the moment.
Mm. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a wild thing that happened. And yeah, I think it's also just like, you know, how you're framing it in terms of like, this is just something that happened to you. It's not a way forward or a manner by which other people can encounter whatever various illnesses, you know. Yeah, so the collapse, that sense of collapse, I think, around the prospect of death, you know, so many people experience it. I guess one of the things that's specific about it around the self is how different it is to grief for somebody else. How different it is to one's world falling apart when you lose a loved one or a beloved family member or a partner. Because I think most of us have experienced that as well. And when the internal collapse, that also kind of begins to project out this external collapse of all things around illnesses that are very threatening, or accidents or moments that are threatening, near misses and things like that. That's a very kind of different thing. And what's been interesting to me about it in my experience of serious illness is there's very clearly two modes that can be met or negotiated when that happens. Either complete fear and the impact that creates, the tension, the tightening, all of those things that pull up drawbridges and, you know, the armor and all those kind of things, and then something else. And I'm not quite sure what the something else is. And I think often the other two, the fear part and the something else combine. But I think ultimately finding whatever that something else is the kind of path. For me, my experience was I was very suddenly diagnosed with bowel cancer when I was 32 on a Friday the 13th and of March, Pisces season. It was like, yeah, only a few days after my 32nd birthday. And what happened next was really revelatory. The most extreme part of it was having to wait to see if it was terminal or not, because the doctors were very worried and it seemed quite on the edge. And it turned out it was stage 3, so it was treatable. And I embarked upon really kind of brutal but life-saving treatment regime thereafter, including chemotherapy, daily radiation for 6 weeks, and multiple surgeries. And that was the type of collapse that, in a funny way, and this is weird, I think we all kind of think about our own capacities for feeling and intuition and, you know, being psychic or things like that. And I think everybody likes to think that about themselves, because we kind of think that we know where we're going. But there, I was waiting for something. And I think that that's really strange. Not an illness or anything like that, but there seemed to be an accumulation of what I can only describe as like very heightened energy in my life, around drama, around attention, around ending up in just situations that I feel like I didn't create. But it's kind of like, you know, that Cookie Muller thing that she says, that quote of like, you know, that she's not dramatic or wild, it just appears in front of her, you know. And sometimes I feel like that, and I think a lot of people, I think especially a lot of artists sometimes can kind of feel things just land. And the later with relate just to stay on that kind of intuition part, because the reason that I went for various tests was solely born out of intuition. I have a very careless and reckless attitude towards my body and health, like I always have. That's not a brag, and it's not a beating myself up. It's just not something that I really pay that much attention to. But 2 years ago, when I was searching in my parents' attic for these like sketches of chairs that I'd made when I was a teenager, and I found all these mad drawings. One of them stood out totally different to the other, and it was a drawing that I'd done as a 14 or 15 year old from a dream, and it was my cancer diagnosis. I was laid out on a particular hospital bed or a CT or MRI machine with an oxygen mask over me. There was a large tumor in the lower part of my torso with kind of symbols and strands coming out of it. And then when I saw this drawing, my blood completely ran cold. But I think what it says is that we understand ourselves into the future, even when we don't know. I've also been quite freaked out about whether that is premonition or whether it is manifestation. You know, those kind of things can be, you can start getting tangled up. However, with regards to the collapse, my life completely fell apart. I was very, very scared that I was going to die. It was happening at a very heightened time in my life because in Ireland, the marriage equality referendum campaign was going on in earnest, and I was giving all of my time to that. And what it developed for me around the suffering and difficulties of the self and one's encounter with mortality and that sense is how that can be navigated and negotiated through broader work for the good externally. This became almost a pathology of mine, that in order to survive my cancer, I had to participate to the nth degree to, you know, contribute to solving this social disease that I was seeing around me, which was homophobia and transphobia and the misogyny that underpins all of that. And I became very obsessed with curing myself through that work and organizing. And in a way, I think that happened. You know, loads of other things happened, you know, very successful medical procedures. Things started to go right when I embraced the prospect of absolute terror. The chemotherapy ended up being effective, as did the radiation. The surgeries were good. My surgeon was great. I had a lot of setbacks, particularly around pain, and really the pain part of it taught me the most, I think. So in these kind of moments of absolute collapse and suffering, I think there are choices. There's one has to get through it, you know, not in an automated way, but really in quite a, you know, kind of solid, kind of grounded way. You are going through it on your own, ultimately, regardless of what support structures or assistance you have around you. And I had fantastic ones. And the things that it instigates in your learning about who you are, why you are, and not like, oh, when this is over, I'm going to set a world record for whatever. You know, it's not about generating ambition out of a sense of potential loss. It's actually about, if this is going to break me in different ways, you know, that can be a good thing. Some things need to be broken. Some practices, some attitudes, some ways of being, some, you know, poor spiritual concepts, they actually need to be broken. And huge personal suffering does a lot of damage. But it also offers this kind of, well, what do I make out of this brokenness? And, you know, whether you're talking about like kintsugi or wabi-sabi concepts in Japanese philosophy around that kind of what can emerge from brokenness, or, you know, general, I don't know, Christian tenets around suffering or different things like that. This kind of confrontation with death that can break so much has taught me more than anything in my life. And it's very a difficult thing to confront, because it's like, obviously I wish it never happened, because I'm still living and experiencing really kind of life-changing ramifications of both the disease and the treatment. And those, you know, are kind of seen now to be lifelong, and they limit my quality of life in some ways. But the depth of new pathways and new ways of being that have developed from that are really profound. And also sometimes I feel like I'm still stuck in that moment. You know, when something collapses so much, it's taking me years to get out of it, kind of psychologically and emotionally, and to make it, you know, a scar and not a wound, you know, that's a really, really long process. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the kind of softening that suffering induces, I guess.
I mean, I think something that we're both kind of touching on is when I say don't take this as medical advice. Mm. Actually, what I mean is don't take any of it as any kind of advice, in the sense of this is what I did to deal with that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I can spot within it things that maybe people can take away. It's not... Let me try to explain what I mean a little bit more. Like, here's like a really just simple analog. It's like people ask me all the time, they're like, what do I do? Like, what book do I read for spiritual development? Like, what do I do? Like, where do I go? What teacher do I... And I'm like, it's you... Like, I don't know. Like, I can tell you some principles, and maybe I could tell you a little bit about what not to do. But even if I told you what not to do, I would still say, and if you feel called to do it, you know? So it's like people, I think, sometimes hear stories like the ones we're telling, and they try to take direct instruction from experience. But what I'm actually talking about, and I think you are too, is within the experience, I can see where I actually touched the truth,
mm-hmm.
which is actually beyond experience. It's beyond actually the events and maneuvers and, you know, dexterous, like, moving around with the things that went on in my life at that time. It was by doing certain things and by having the totality of the encounter and moving with it that sometimes the truth appeared. And I can talk a little bit about what I see as the truth in these moments. So, for instance, one thing I can say is we both talked about still carrying these events with the way that it appeared, and then you were like, fuck, this is going to have to be carried. All this is going to have to be carried in one way or another, and the way that it still lives. For me, I see in that, as you touched on it, this Christian ideal of love thy enemy. Love your enemy. When this appeared as a challenge, an enemy, a thing I had to overcome. And immediately I was like, well, I'm not going back to the doctor, but I'm going to do, like, I was already vegan. So I was like, I'm going to do like macrobiotic diet and like see these man. I'm going to like just do this for like a year and a half and like just try to like see if that helps, even though I don't necessarily believe in what they say, but I'm so anxious about it that I've got to do this and this and this and blah, blah. And those were all the techniques. That was me trying to defeat something. But now when I look, I actually say the same as you, which is what came from this encounter with this presence, which was so huge. And for me, it was disease process presence, but also though not as intense as yours in the procedures afterwards, but the intensity of like the love abuse experience and all the other like life changes all happening in that moment. It was like everything I had learned up to that moment, all the like information. I was a pretty smart guy. It was like this thing coming at me, and all I had to fight it with was like a wilted flower, you know, like all my intellect went away. I was so small in the presence of this encounter. And I had the only thing I had to turn to was the truth. And for me, it just was not true to go back with the medical experience and continue. It wasn't true to go back to the boyfriend who had beat me up, even though I loved him, still probably love him desperately. I never saw him again. Well, I bumped into him once. Which is a whole other story, because I bumped into him like decades later, or like maybe 15 years later, and the rib he broke popped out of place like that. Ooh, when I saw him, like, just,
it was crazy. And I had to get physical therapy for like a month after that. But it wasn't true for me. Like, that was just not in my integrity. So I knew that I was at least close to something that was true. And I had to filter through a lot. Am I just denying this? Like, am I just like disavowing the words that I heard from the doctor? Am I running away from a problem by not calling the police? Like, all those kinds of things that came up. And I had to actually stay as close as I could to the truth. And what that revealed to me is what's important.
Mm. I think as well, what the things that I've kind of really learned at in the moment and in the aftermath is one's perception of what a challenge is. Because in my mind, in the lead up, I was quite sick in the lead up to my diagnosis. And I had experienced a period of extraordinary stress. I had published a book on the movement for marriage equality in Ireland, which was met with a really difficult social and political context in Ireland, where I kind of was, you know, quasi-censored from discussing it on Irish media due to these so-called balance rules. And that kind of hurt its publicity. And I was really resentful and angry over that, because I felt like I had done, you know, this is a history book. This was yet again another kind of version of this kind of oppressive society getting into me. And the other thing was, I was really, really convinced that year, that time was going to be totally sucked up by this challenge of, you know, the referendum and the constitutional change, and all of my friends and comrades and people who were really going to be giving everything to it. And of course, that ended up not being the challenge. The challenge was, are you going to survive? And how are you going to survive? But that was thematic anyway, because my survival was dependent on not living in a place that, and it's not about marriage, you know, as everybody knows in these movements, it's actually about how do we heal this society. And
it's an important distinction for you to make for the American listeners to the show, because a lot of obviously queer resistance in the US is like anti-marriage, but in Ireland, the marriage equality happened by referendum, which took place through conversations between people. So the entire thing was not a court state procedure in the way that it was in some other places. So it's a completely different form. And like the consequence of losing that after those discussions and meeting your neighbors and talking about love took place would have been massively different.
I think. It was really about the equality part, not the marriage part. And of course, you know, subsequently got married last year, but it was really about addressing, you know, the theocratic framework that created so much homophobia in Irish society. But it was interesting, it's like, oh, that's not the challenge, that wasn't the challenge at all, but the survival part is the same, you know, because whether you are killed or really seriously injured or set back by a disease or by a society, or by a relationship, or by, you know, a bad career path, or whatever it is, you know, the thriving and the surviving and the healing is kind of the same in a funny way. Some of it takes physical form. The other, and that speaks to a friend of mine who's a theater maker. Once passed on this piece of advice from another theater maker in terms of making a show, was that your plan A is actually your plan B. Mm. Every idea or concept that you have about something, a challenge, an artwork, whatever it is, a plan, are all of the conceptions that you have about it before you actually encounter it. When you encounter it, it reveals itself with all of these new variables and challenges that you wouldn't have conceived. So your plan A is actually your plan B, and the thing that emerges is your plan A. Mm-hmm. So my plan A was full tilt referendum, gonna give it everything. But actually the plan A was like, oh, how are you going to traverse this life-threatening illness? And then by proxy, you know, a two-way street of bringing in the love and the division and the discourse into yourself and giving to that, and both of those things will become strangely symbiotic. Mm. And the other thing I think is around fear and our conceptions and perceptions of how we deal in crisis. And it seems to me that a lot of people who really fear crisis and collapse within themselves or their personal life, or their romantic life or familial life, whatever it is, haven't really encountered that level of drama. And actually, we all, I think, deal extraordinarily well in moments of personal collapse and crisis. It's actually other people's crises that tend to disarm us and freeze us, and where we tend to not deal so well with, because we don't know what methods and tools and gestures and ways to give or offer for somebody else. This is like the blessing and curse of adaptation and adaptability. But the thing that I went to was, okay, now is the time. You know, this has happened, and now is the time. And I have to go inside of myself. I've always considered myself quite a strong person, obstinate, anti-authoritarian, defiant, all those kind of things. I have to go inside myself and find all of these things that have an edge to them within me that can now be utilized with this very, very clear grounding and resolve. And if I find that truth within myself, regardless of what happens, even if I die, even if XYZ doesn't work out, I will have actually found that kind of, you know, the sword in the rock, you know, deep within me, and I'll be able to kind of pull it out and wield it and yield to certain things as well, and give myself over to myself, my really, you know, the deep bedrock of myself, not just the crust that we, like, you know, demonstrate day to day. And then the other part, which I think is quite pertinent to so many kind of global challenges today, is the softening. Trauma and crisis and collapse and pain and hardship can harden. You know, they really can harden your heart, and they can make you fearful. They can put you back into that mode where you're terrified, you're in this defense position, be it like the animal being chased or the person about to strike out. And I've been in that also for a long time, and I try and get out of it as much as I can. But that is a really damaging stance to the self. Apart from it being a paralyzed one, it's a hard one. And what we need to constantly do is soften. And this is the thing that we need to understand about strength, that it is not about might. It's about a softening. And the more you soften yourself and yourself towards other people and towards, you know, the enemy, actually also, how whatever form that takes, or the person that you quote unquote hate, or the more you do that, the more the answers show up as to how to actually move forward. You can't, fear does not move things forward. Fear is a regressive force, always, in any kind of aspect of the world. And love is the one that has momentum. And once you soften in that way, the surprises that you give yourself are manifold. I mean, look, I'm talking Zen here. You know what I'm like. I'm very kind of spiky person. Yeah. So this doesn't mean that you have to go around like a wellness bro and or prothelicizing or anything like that. But it has to be an internal softening so that you can find the pathway and the solutions in conflict, in crisis, and when there really appear to be extraordinarily terrible forces at play that are causing suffering of others.
Yeah, well, Okay, so obviously there's a lot there. First, I want to just say, you know, touching on regarding the pain of others again is something that Susan Sontag says that you've echoed, which is it's not so much seeing images of violence again and again that like makes people feel like, you know, like inured, like that makes people feel like they can just watch it and feel nothing. It's actually having no idea what to do when you see them. Because who knows how much we should connect to the images or not connect to the images? Who knows what kind of feeling life response we should have? But it's the fact that nobody can really think or do anything around the feelings that right. becomes a problem.
Paralysis of the crisis of others.
Yeah, exactly. When you're talking about the softening, yeah, let me just maybe add a piece to that. You know, when I think about what's needed in terms of, when I think about, well, sorry, I'm going to step all that back. Thanks, listeners, for letting me do that. First, I want to say that in both cases, the brush with death, with seeing that death is within us at all times, I mean, what could be a better image than the skeleton, you know, which is literally the skeleton that's walking inside of us all the time. You know, when my mother died when I was 23, she basically became a skeleton before she died. I mean, she just kept losing weight and losing weight until it was just like the thinnest layer of flesh upon bone, and her hair had fallen out. And, you know, just watching her go through that process and become the visage of death, really. But yet still, like, loving her as she went away in that way. I think that lesson and then the lesson of confronting my own actually handled hers, actually a little bit of an inverse of what you said. I handled hers a bit better than my own. In fact, her panic around her own death, I think, not to blame her, of course she's allowed to feel whatever she wants, but it trained my panic. Like, she had a real fucking panic, and I get why, you know, obviously I get why. But that was how I was raised to see death coming, you know. And nobody else's parents were dying at that time either, so I didn't have any other models, you know. It was like, okay, you're 23 and you're the one with the dead mom, you know. But being able to live with death is so important. I mean, so completely important. And not with a brazen, defiant attitude like, well, so what if I die, I die. Or like, people die. Like, who gives a shit? Like, everybody dies. But no, like, understanding what that transition point. Again, a different way of losing all the conditions of everything. Whether you accept that there is a life between this one and the next, or that there is a next life or whatever. Or if you just think it's the end. I don't accept that, but as true. Well, I don't experience that as true. But the either way, understanding that thing that exists for all of us, that condition, which is the end of all conditions, it's so important, and it's just completely shaped the way that I approach and encounter everything. And that began, the real understanding of that began, I guess, when my mom died. And I'm so, I mean, talk about loving your enemy. I mean, death is like, I'm so thankful for it. I'm so thankful for it in so many ways, the things that it teaches me, the ways in which it brings an understanding of the end of everything, not just people, but, or animals, but landscapes, mountains, oceans, ideas, friendships, relationships, all these things that will end. And yet I understand as something is within me that is eternal, which will continue. But you don't have to accept that, but just know that that end is arriving for all of us, the death of everything. Yeah.
I think as well, the code, not to, I mean, I'm using tech language here, but the code of hope is in despair, because otherwise there would be no need for it. You know, and that's such a specific human emotion and a collective emotion and desire. And, you know, how I feel about death in general may not be rooted to concepts of afterlife, but actually it kind of is, because obviously our connection exists and carries on within people. That can become a very heavy thing, you know, and some people call that grief. And I think I agree to, you know, you can't be trivial about these things, or you can't just package Ram Dassisms and say, well, everybody dies, you know. Yeah. And I love Ram Dass, you know, for the record, but like I think that we have to look at, we think a lot about the negative shadows or the Jungian shadows or things like that, but what we also have to talk about is what the light that exists within the shadow as well. And I think you're really, really seeing this in a very, very pronounced way globally right now with regards to the connection, the activism, the organizing, the solidarity building, the scream of no in relation to what's happening to Palestinian people, and the impact that that is going to have on our own capacity to hope and change and bring forth something better, because there's a big difference between death and unnecessary death.
Yeah.
And death and killing, you know, these are very, very different things. And I feel, I don't know, sometimes I think I cope much better in terms of how I view humanity and the future positively in times of great despair, because within that the level of darkness is so profound that any light that comes through is actually extraordinarily bright, and we have to really follow those flashes and those little chinks and those little spots that come out of that, because they are fundamentally where we need to go. When the chips are down, are you going to show up in a mode of love, or are you going to show up in a mode of blithe ignoring something, trying to rationalize it or trivialize it, or, you know, negating it or brushing it off? You know, and I think we saw a lot of that in a very cruel way during the pandemic, when a lot of, you know, kind of sociopathic political leaders were just like, well, I guess loads of people are going to die. You know, these are souls. They're loved and beloved people. So, but within that, that's what I've learned anyway myself, that I was terrified briefly. And after that, something else happened and changed, that it's like, oh my God, this is all going to end. No more me, no more of my ambitions, dreams, desires, the things I never did.
Yeah.
So what is in there, excuse me, that I can pull out? And you can be very, very surprised by what you find.
Yeah. A few things. Yeah, killing and death are different. One of the big reasons why they're different, and this is something that we can think about in terms especially of Palestine and all the things that we've talked about when we're talking about renewals, killing is, yeah, the person dies, and that is something that comes for all of us. But that person dies, and their death actually marks the destruction of the person that killed them as well.
Correct.
And that is so terrible. When we look at the people that are doing the killing, and I'm not saying that we need to shift all our sympathy to them, but we have to think about, how do we live now with all these people who are doing killing, who have ended the lives of others and destroyed their own lives, and in a lot of ways that will echo out into the lives of their families, the public life, all that kind of stuff. Those kinds of deaths create tangles for the living in a different way as well. And obviously they're also completely tragic for the person who has died and their loved ones. When someone dies, everything that they were becomes available to all of us. And so that's why when someone is killed, the violence of how they died enters into us as well. When someone that you know dies, for instance, the whole group of friends and family, they all have these little pieces that they can bring to each other, and they can feel the presence of that person in them in a different way. And so when they die, that transition state where they're moving from that condensed address of who they are as a being into all of us is something that we experience as grief.
Mm-hmm.
So the movement of their address of individuality into all of us is what we experience as grief. Now, I just want to say one more thing about the softening, and then we'll wrap it up, which seems crazy because this conversation could go on and on. When the feeling of softening, if I think about that, if I think about something making either an imprint on me, so it's like I'm able to receive something because it's able to enter in a way or like nestle against me. And there's that other picture of strength, which is I'm going to just be strong and resilient and nothing's going to fuck with me. I do think that both those things are necessary, but what we should bring to each of those pictures is the other picture. So in other words, when I'm encountering something that requires resilience, can I be, or strength, like an unmovingness, sorry, not just resilience, an unmovingness, that pillar, can I be that or embody that in a way that also makes way, that also allows for movement? And when I need to be that kind of soft strength that allows the impression or makes an impression on the world, can I actually receive the impression or create the impression in a way that also heals the track that I've left? And those two together, like bringing those two qualities together, is what I'm seeking. And it's something that I actually hear in your story and that I hear in my story as well. So when I think about renewal and the strength that comes out of renewal, it is a resilience that allows, an absolute like column of strength that allows movement, and an impression that receives healing as it's impressed.
Right. And these metaphors of like columns and pillars are really important. You know, I think in the personal apocalypse, which is the kind of direct encounter with death or a very immediate possibility of that, you do have to go inside and see, okay, is that pillar there? And it will be. You know, anybody who's going through a major crisis at the moment, be it grief or illness or anything like that, that is there. You know, so it might look a little cracked or covered with moss or whatever within you, but it is there. And in the aftermath, then that moves outward and it almost becomes a kind of a staff, you know, and you have to kind of decide, do I use this to like wield and beat and strike, or do I use it to support me and others? Do I use it as this thing that actually now goes in front of me when I'm walking? That this inner thing, the resolve, the strength, the resilience, whatever you want to call it, becomes external and can be used to go forward. And now you have developed, you have externalized this hugely powerful protective tool, guiding tool, supportive tool, that then goes in front of you and leads you on. And we see that in death all the time. We see it in also what other people's deaths teach us and what we take from their death and their life and add, you know, add to our own kind of understanding and our own pathways. I'm thinking especially about a dear friend of mine who I lost 2 years ago. And really having this moment at her wake, which is obviously a very important ritual in Irish society, where she was laid out and she was wearing her kufya. She's very, very passionate about the cause of the Palestinian people. And now, you know, every day I think about that. I see her body, you know, and I see that guidance that she was offering at that moment. And we all know those kind of touchstones, and they're not memory. There's something else, you know, and in our own encounters with death and mortality and the sliding doors of all those things, some object, some image, some feeling and gesture is there, and being gifted that staff is really transformative. Mm. If you're not using it as the thing to beat.
Well, listen, everybody, obviously it's not like we came to five things to do to renew yourself in an apocalypse, to renew yourself as you approach death or whatever. It's not like that. And I hope that actually that is, if we actually do impart a lesson, maybe that's it. It's not like that. Just as each of our deaths will be individual, yet death is universal. There is like this movement back and forth between the universal and the particular. And the particular is given as advice way too often. We're talking about our particulars here to aim towards something. And I hope that it's helpful. I mean, even just listening to you, Una, it's like, it's just helpful for me. It's helpful for me all the time, but it's just helpful for me in creating a picture that's like, it's actually creative. It's actually a creative picture, a creation picture, because it's not bound by any sort of pat sort of a punctuated thing. And I think that that's a real gift. So again, thank you for everything.
Great. And hopefully a bunch of your listeners will be tuning into the live stream on the 28th. I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be juicy.
It'll be great. And if you're listening to this after the event has passed and died, well, you're welcome. Bye now.